Stephanie Kelton is the professor of public policy and economics at Stony Brook University, former chief economist to the U.S. Senate Budget Committee and advisor to Bernie Sanders in 2016. She's a founding fellow of the Sanders Institute. Stephanie Kelton, S-T-E-P-H-A-N-I-E, Kelton, K-E-L-T-O-N.com is her website. You can tweet her at Stephanie Kelton. Stephanie, welcome back to the program, or Dr. Kelton.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So this piece that you're quoted from The Atlantic, a promise so big Democrats aren't sure how to keep it, about guaranteed jobs. How does this fit in with modern monetary theory?
Well, I guess the clearest way to connect the two, it's always been part of the MMT kind of framework of analysis, but maybe the best way to think about the way they fit together is that, you know, we can answer the how are you going to pay for it question.
Mm-hmm. So how do we answer that?
Well, you know, so MMT, and you and I have talked about this on your show a number of times before, you know, generally speaking, with big policy proposals like the federal job guarantee, the first question that anybody gets in Washington, D.C. is, of course, how are you going to pay for it? And that usually stops the conversation, right? Because the answer usually involves some combination of increases in a variety of taxes where, you know, at least with divided Congress, it gets pretty difficult to see how you could ever enact legislation. So the conversation normally doesn't get beyond just, wouldn't it be nice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you could do what the Republicans just did, which is stay very focused on the goals and objectives and mount support for your agenda and then just pass the legislation, the Republicans had no problem, of course, recently passing sweeping tax cuts that are estimated to add $1.5 trillion to deficits over the next 10 years. So they didn't get bogged down and hung up on the pay-for question. They just said, look, this is good policy. This is their story, and they're sticking to it, right? This is good policy, and we're going to pass this thing, and it's going to create lots of jobs and growth for the economy. Now, the Democrats could come in if they managed to get control of the White House, the House, and the Senate, and put together legislation and say, we're going to pass a federal job guarantee, and we're just going to pass the thing, and we're not going to add a bunch of tax increases and cuts and offsets and other programs, because we understand that a program like this is going to cost something, right? It's going to cost an estimated, let's say, $550 billion per year as we begin to implement the program. But it's going to create a variety of savings in a whole host of other ways. All the ways in which we currently pay for unemployment and poverty and the ancillary and associated economic and social costs, that's going to offset much of the spending we're talking about. So you plow through the discussion without getting bogged down in, you know, whose taxes are going to go up and that sort of a thing. And I think MMT gives you the space to be able to have that sort of a policy discussion.
How is a guaranteed job program, which we actually have experience with, you know, Franklin Roosevelt did this during the Great Depression with the WPA and the CCC and other programs, you know, where capitalism has failed, so government steps in and make sure you can still work and support your family and keep your family intact and all that kind of thing. How is that different from a guaranteed minimum income, which we've kind of flirted with, I suppose, with the tax credits, you know, I forget the name of it, but, you know, the tax credits that are offered to very, very low
income. Income tax credits.
Thank you. Yes. You know, but and arguably we kind of flirt with that with programs ranging from food stamps to housing subsidies and whatnot. It seems that so many of these programs, and there's dozens and dozens of them, could be simply replaced with a guaranteed minimum income, and it would increase efficiency at the very least in terms of distribution of resources to people. I'm curious your thoughts on that, the universal basic income. And B, how is that different from or complementary to or even in contrast with the idea of guaranteed jobs?
So you're right. A lot of people will talk about something, and you said it at the very end. It's not the same as expanding their earned income tax credit, right? A universal basic income, if it means what people really intend it to mean, I guess, which is that it's universal. That means you get it, I get it, Oprah gets it, Bill Gates gets it, everybody gets it. You get a check, and you get a check, right? It's
just like Social Security.
Everybody, what's that?
Just like Social Security.
Well, but Social Security, well, okay, so it's like Social Security once you reach eligibility.
Right, but I mean, so Bill Gates can get Social Security just like I can.
Yeah, so what happens sometimes, there's so many different proposals for a universal basic income. It's often hard for me to comment because I don't know what somebody has in mind. Some people say that kids should get. Okay, maybe every child gets $6,000, every adult gets $12,000 every year.
They do that in Alaska, don't they?
What's that?
Don't they do that in Alaska with the, I'm sorry, you can't hear me. Don't they do that in Alaska with the Alaska Permanent Fund? Every child?
Well, but it's not a living, so this again comes back to one of these problems when you have these discussions with people who propose a universal basic income. If it's truly a basic income, it's supposed to be enough for a person to survive on. It's supposed to be enough to meet your basic needs. Of course, that's not what happens in Alaska. The Alaska dividend could be $1,250 one year, it could be $1,700 another year, it could be $2,100 one year, it goes up, but it also goes down. It's not uniform. And so that's normally not what people think of. When they think of a universal basic income, it's a standardized payment that goes to everybody, right? Those at the very top, those at the very bottom, and everybody in between. Well, I have a number of concerns, and I have for a long time, with the UBI as compared to a federal job guarantee program. The job guarantee program is targeted, right? It is saying, look, if you want employment, if you want to work, if you want to contribute, you can't find anybody to employ you. Nobody in the private sector, there's no public sector job. You want to work, but you can't find a job. Then what the job guarantee does is provide a public option in the labor market. Anybody who wants to work and can't find work anywhere else in the economy can come take a job in the public service employment program. So it's targeted. It also moves with the business cycle. So in a weak economy, the program automatically scales up. You absorb people who are losing their jobs in an economic downturn. But as the economy improves, the program automatically shrinks in size, and so you end up spending less. So it is what we call a counter-cyclical program. And so it has stabilizing effects for the overall economy. In contrast, the universal basic income is sending out the same standardized payment at all points in the business cycle. So when the economy is really booming and things are heating up, maybe you're getting some inflationary pressure, labor markets are very tight, people are still being sent the same standardized check. And we think one of the potential risks in doing that is that you have no way of controlling inflation in a scheme like that. The other thing is that, you know, what often happens is people say, let's replace this huge bureaucratic welfare system that we have, and let's just simplify. You mentioned efficiency. We'll just make it more efficient. We'll send everybody a check, and you figure out how to save for your retirement. You figure out how to plan for your health care. You figure out, so all these other programs that you mentioned, like food stamps and Section 8 housing vouchers, all these other programs that are there today to help protect and safeguard people from unemployment compensation, from homelessness, whatever, hunger, and so forth, those programs are gone because they're being used to, quote, pay for the universal basic income. So now you've eliminated the social safety net, replaced it with a single program, right? A program that some people might characterize as a free money program. And the people at the very top are going to take their basic income check and say thank you very much and buy shares of Apple or whatever the case may be. Their wealth is going to automatically increase. And we're subsidizing that increased wealth for people at the top who don't need that additional income to survive. People at the bottom are going to consume every bit of the income that they receive. So they're going to, I think the risk, another risk is exacerbating inequality, particularly wealth inequality.
So it sounds like you're not a fan of universal basic income, and I get it, and it makes perfect sense why. But the job guarantee, because it's countercyclical, if we're going to stay with a relatively unregulated capitalist system, particularly when it comes to things like mergers and acquisitions, you know, Reagan in 82 stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Act, so that we have even more exaggerated swings in our economy because, you know, it's so highly verticalized, that we really need to do this with a jobs program, a guaranteed jobs program.
Well, I think
we have 1 minute left.
Idea,
by the way,
I kind of hate the idea of saying let's accept all of these other things that you know, these changes to tax laws, trade, and everything else that we've done, and let's just provide a universal job guarantee because we have this really messed up economic system that is constantly going to be throwing
No, I'm not saying that, please.
But it is true that we have an economic system that is prone to crisis. This is goes back to Keynes or the general theory and even beyond, right?
Yep.
Go back to Marx. We have an economic system that is crisis prone. And we should be doing much more in terms of changing laws and regulatory policy, trade, and so forth to limit the degree to which our economy is unstable. We're never going to perfectly have, you're not going to have a capitalist economy that can go through business cycles, right?
Yeah. Yep. Stephanie, we're hitting the break here. I really appreciate this conversation. You've helped recalibrate my thinking, which I really appreciate. Dr. Stephanie Kelton, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Stephanie Kelton,
you're
hang in
listening
a second.
To Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The website is StephanieKelton.com, and you can tweet her at Stephanie Kelton.